Monster Professor.
Welcome to the Monster Professor, a show in which we discuss and explore monsters in literature, myth, film, games, folklore, culture, and beyond. I'm your host, Josh Woods, author, editor, professor, and monster expert. And for the writing side of news, I should say, first of all, a few book tour events at various colleges and universities went really well the past month. So if any of you are listening to this show who are a part of that in attendance or put it together as organizers, thank you so much. I think those were a lot of fun and I hope you had fun too. Also, right now, I'm still guest editor for Prime Number Magazine, an upcoming issue, the October through December issue of 2019, issue 163. A lot of excellent stories have been pouring in for that. I get to pick only three to publish, and I say keep them coming and send me your best stuff. They don't have to be monster stories. You don't have to pander to me. I'm only interested in fiction that does really well what it is trying to do. And so I want to see good stories. I don't care what genre or what style. So keep them coming. Send me your best stuff. And you can find out all the details and get links to the submittable site and all the guidelines through press53.com. Check out their newest issue, issue 151. Lots of great fiction and poetry in that issue as well. And that will also lead you to guidelines and links to submit. All right. So for today's episode, I wasn't sure what to do. I've got a lot on the slate, and I've got some interviews upcoming, and I've got an open spot for today's, and I was all over the place on which ones I wanted to do. And then this morning, digging up old bricks out of the yard and fixing a part of the yard, and man, I dug up some monster worms and all sorts of little like crawling maggots, but especially these monster night crawlers. And I thought, oh, this is telling me what episode to do today. We should do an episode on worms.
Broke into the wrong goddamn rec room, didn't you, you bastard?
So let's start with the word worm, because that can be confusing for a lot of people who, say, are used to the more modern sense, but then jump back into older legends and myths, especially anything in Old English. And so the modern sense of worm is this invertebrate creature that's gross and slimy and loves crawling through the ground, and it's basically tube-shaped with very little extra on top of that. But you might have noticed different spellings of worm, like W-Y-R-M or even W-U-R-M. And in Old English, that type of worm was actually, it didn't exclude the kinds of worms we think, but it was a much larger category. Anything that was bug-like in that way, but also any type of reptile that was serpent or snake-like. And so worm could also mean dragon or snake or serpent, and that comes from Old Germanic or Proto-Germanic, and you see that word being translated and carried over, and even the root, the say Proto-Indo-European root, showing up in other words like when vermis in Latin, or where we get like vermin, comes from that same root where worm came from. And so the much older category included serpents and what we consider like these earthworm type of creatures, but it also included like maggots and scorpions, and was very often associated with venom or poison and illness and that kind of thing. And so It's safe to say, like, if you're talking about worms, you could mix in those tube-shaped invertebrate creatures, but you could also mix in serpents and dragons if you really wanted to, since we did a whole episode on serpents and dragons and are likely to do some more. I'll focus more on the ones that seem more like the monsters that seem like the modern sense of the worm. However, I think there's plenty of crossover, and I don't think we'll be entirely able to avoid the crossover between worm and dragon, nor would I try, even if we wanted to. So the first one I want to talk about, I want to get to at least four specific ones if I can today in my regular episode time. The first one I want to talk about for sure is perhaps my favorite, and it's Shamir. And I'm talking about Shamir the worm, as in the one Solomon used or befriended. I say my favorite, and I don't know if it feels like my favorite necessarily, but objectively it is, because it became a big part of my novel, The Black Palace, by the way, available on Amazon.com. It was kind of, in a way, the MacGuffin, but I should back up. And when we, in storytelling, when we say MacGuffin, we're borrowing a term from screenwriting, in which there's some object that is pushing forward the plot because all sorts of characters want to get a hold of that object, whether it's like the Ark of the Covenant, or whether it is some kind of, well, Hitchcock, Alfred Hitchcock made it famous. So he preferred a MacGuffin that was kind of unknown, like the microfilm, and it had on it stuff that nobody really knew, and it didn't matter. It just helped the plot get pushed forward. And so in my novel, The Black Palace, Shamir the Worm ends up becoming that in a lot of ways. And so it's this, Shamir is this old Hebrew or Jewish piece of folklore, and it shows up in all sorts of midrash commentary about the holy texts, the Talmud and the Midrashim. And it's actually a little worm, although some versions of it say, oh, it must have been just like a special stone or something. But most description, it's this tiny, tiny little worm. And here's how it came into the story. Solomon needed to build the great temple, and eventually did. But how did he do so? And how did he carve through these huge slabs of stone without the use of, say, giants? If these things weren't cyclopean, how were these things cut? Also, it mattered that Solomon's temple was going to be a bastion of peace and unity. And if that were the case, then it would be wrong to use sharp objects that could do violence, like blades and tools and chisels and these kinds of things. And so if you can't use weapon-like things to build the temple, what can you do? Well, Solomon found out about this Shamir that was hidden somewhere in the world, and he didn't know where it was. But the legend goes that this little worm could cut through anything. A little worm could somehow slice through stone at any depth and any hardness. It could cut through metal. It could cut through diamonds if it wished. And how did it do that? It was never really clear. I mean, some of the tales say that its gaze, it seemed to have eyes in some way. So I imagine it being something that looks more like a cute caterpillar, but with eyes. And maybe its gaze cut through it. I like to think it just sends a sheer plane of annihilation, like one atom thick, through anything it decides to cut. At least that's kind of how it is in my version of Shamir. So he had heard about this thing, and he needs to go find it, and it's beyond his ability and his wisdom as a mere man. And so he uses his immense knowledge and wisdom in the what we would consider the occult, and being able to draw circles of confinement and protection and summon demons. And he does this. And in fact, the circles and the sigils and the spells that he used are preserved in the occult tradition, that is, in the Keys of Solomon. There's the Greater Key of Solomon, and then the much more interesting Lesser Key of Solomon, that is an encyclopedia of demons and their sigils. And it will also tell you how to draw circles and how to do the whole summoning so that you keep yourself protected when you're dealing with demons. I'm sure we're going to get into that in an episode on demons in the future at some point. But for now, let's suffice it to say that he summoned a demon named Asmodeus. And he might have actually been a Persian demon, and a Zoroastrian demon that kind of got imported into the cosmos of the Israelites. Asmodeus shows up in the Book of Tobit. Some of your Bibles have the Book of Tobit. Some of them don't. Probably the Catholic Bible. If any of you have a Catholic Bible, it'll probably have the Book of Tobit. And that's mostly a demon fighting book. It's a really good one. It's too bad that some of the Protestant ones cut it out. But if you read it, and you can see how it's much more a fun kind of folklore monster fighting, book than some of the other ones around it. So you can see why maybe Protestants would want to cut it out. But it's too bad. Put it back in there anyway. And so he summons Asmodeus and he says, "Go forth and find me, Shamir." And then Asmodeus has to, because he's been bound and summoned and ordered by Solomon the Great. And so he goes out and there are various folk tales about how he ends up finding it with the help of a bird up in the nest in a tree. And so Shamir is kept. He's a tiny little thing. He's like the size of barley corn or a grain of rice or something like that. I made him a little bit bigger and fatter and cuter in my book. But he has to be kept on either a ball of cotton or a ball of wood, or wool, not wood, a ball of cotton or a ball of wood in a little lead box. Otherwise, he would burn through or cut through anything that he was on. And so he's kept in this little box, and you bring him out, and you set his little fat belly on a little stone. And at least in my version, we don't know how it works, but at least in my version of it, you just set them on anything you want sliced in half and you just tell them, go at it. In my version, he's a sleepy little fellow. He just mostly likes to be left alone, but he enjoys breaking the hell out of things. I don't see any reason why, if he can cut through anything, if he can cut through the deepest stone or the toughest diamonds or iron or any of this stuff, why he couldn't, if commanded, cut the very world itself in half. I think that's worrisome. And so, in my book, it is worrisome. So who knew that we had a magical biblical little worm? Well, a lot of people did. But anyway, I think he might have been lesser known, and I'm trying to make him as popular as can possibly be because he's so wonderful. Because it seems like such an odd thing. Like if it were a magic chisel or a special sword or a dragon-like demon that could cut these stones, none of that would be as surprising and as fascinating as this tiny little worm is the one who can do this kind of thing. I think it's pretty freaking cool. So as a brief transition to some other worms, maybe we should mention at least a minute about wereworms. Where do you find wereworms? It actually shows up in Tolkien ever so briefly in The Hobbit. There's a reference to the weirworms. Now, in the parlance of our times, anytime we add "were" in front of any sort of animal, we think of it as a shapeshifter kind of thing, and it can mean that. But "were" was also just an old English word for man, and so it could be a man-like thing, or it could be a thing that turns from man to that thing and back again. And it's never quite clear what the weirworms are. Maybe it's just man-sized or man-like worms, or maybe it's guys who turn into these worms. But Bilbo Baggins, early on in the book, is trying to puff himself up and let everybody know that he can do whatever they tell him to do. And he says, "Tell me what you want done, and I will try it. If I have to walk from here to the east of east and fight the wild wereworms in the last desert." And so, and we never find out what those things are. Thank goodness. I think they might have made the decision to like add those into some of the Hobbit movies, but I'm gonna let those lie. I think a little bit more interesting is that in some of the earliest pieces of the drafts of the Hobbit, as they went back through in Tolkien's work, they found a version of it in which Bilbo talks about the great desert. He's going to walk all the way to the great desert of Gobi and fight the wild wireworms of the Chinese. This was much, much earlier on in the drafting of these kinds of things, as Tolkien imagined his Middle Earth being set in a much earlier Europe. And then that quickly faded away. But the reference to like the Gobi Desert in the Far East, those are references to the Mongolian death worm of the Gobi Desert, and in the era of these kinds of archaeological discoveries of the ancient East, like in the 1920s and so on. This book came out in which this guy was describing the various the Mongolian myths and legends, and well, mostly archaeology. But he kept getting reports of this Mongolian death worm. It was this gigantic worm, I don't know, like 3-5 feet long, and it was bright red, and it lived almost all year long underground, and you would never see it. But for 2 of the rainy months per year, it would rise up. Of course, worms do rise up when the ground's over-soaked, so maybe there's a little bit of truth behind this. It would rise up, and you'd need to stay far away from it, because if you even just barely touched it, it would instantaneously kill you. Now, what kills you? Most of the stories sound like it was poison, like it was so poisonous that the mere touch would kill you. But others say it was like an electrical charge, and it would shock you instantaneously to death. And I think there are a lot of Gobi Desert inhabitants who still think that this thing is no joke, that it is actually for real. And I think there have been like various cryptozoologists or zoologists who have gone out there and tried to find it. They never ended up coming up with anything. But who am I to say that you're safe? I imagine if I went out into the Gobi Desert and just tried to look for monsters, I would die in one way or another. And it wouldn't be entirely clear whether a monster had done that or my own stupidity. And so I don't think we're safe out there. Who knows? But this Mongolian death worm, so where are we going to go? Tolkien to Mongolian death worm to Frank Herbert. How about that? Because I think that Mongolian death worm was a huge influence on what is probably the most thought out and the most detailed worm monster that we have in any sort of storytelling. And those are the sandworms of Dune. And that's, I'm talking about Frank Herbert's excellent novel, Dune. And of course, I should say series, because of course it was much more than just one novel. It continued, and then even after his death, it continues still. And they'll keep trying to make movies and TV shows out of it. I'm convinced it can't happen, though. It's kind of like Lovecraft. Like, it's too great as it is. In the novels and the things about it that make the novel so great don't really translate to film like everybody thinks they will. And so I think there's something that's there's kind of a cinematic history of attempts at Dune kind of being cursed to failure. And so I think maybe there's something behind that. I say let it be, but they're going to keep trying it. Who knows? Maybe it'll work one day. And so the sandworms are these, I mean, when I say gigantic worms, they are like the Muad'Dib rides ends up being like a mile and a half long or something like that. Like, these are massive, amazing beasts on the desert planet of Arrakis, and they're also known as makers. I think the indigenous people, the Freemen, call them the Shai-Hulud, and there are a whole bunch of other names for them. In Frank Herbert's world, Dune, ever so briefly, and I'm going to really dumb it down, and I'll probably screw up a detail or two because I'm not a Dune expert in the way that maybe I am a Tolkien expert. That the world of Dune turns by this resource that they very often refer to as spice. And this spice only comes from this desert planet of Arrakis, and it only comes from this planet because it's a byproduct of, say, the biology of the sandworms. And so this spice is like this, is this cinnamon-like substance. It seems to be powdery and cinnamon-colored, and is like a lot of references in Eastern, or say Middle Eastern tales, or even Mediterranean tales of cinnamon. And it is a kind of drug, but it's like this superpower drug that, depending on how you take it and how much, it can extend your life. I don't know if it can entirely make you immortal, but that there were hints at that, if I remember correctly. But it can extend your life into the hundreds of years. And it can also, depending on who you are and what your innate abilities are, it can help you become what we might call psychic or prescient, as in you can see things to the future. And that is how interstellar travel is possible in Frank Herbert's futuristic, far future world, story world in Dune. And why can't you just use supercomputers to calculate the paths to the stars through space and time? Well, because the Butlerian Jihad, I guess we would say, they, an ancient revolution that reacted against any machines that mimic the human mind, they were wiped out and forever banned. And so that's just a non-starter in the story world. And so they need people who are capable of being that smart, whether it's Mentats or it's people that are beyond the guildmasters, I think, or people who are so far above and beyond normal human calculations and predictions that they can act and think like supercomputers themselves and guide the ships. The only way to do all that stuff and to get people that smart and that capable mentally is to feed them a whole lot of spice, or like surround them in spice clouds. And that means spice keeps the galaxy turning. And we gotta keep having it, which means, of course, and there are all these political battles over control of Arrakis, and it all hinges around what is essentially a natural beast, this gigantic worm-like thing. Now, Frank Herbert, as far as I can, well, I've got plenty of reason to think this, in part because of what he wrote. He was an extremely intelligent guy, and the breadth and depth of his knowledge was astounding. And so I would say that, well, I'll read to you in a moment what he said about his creation of sandworms, but because he created a world in imaginative fiction so rich and so successful, I think that's kind of evidence in and of itself that he knew so much and he was so smart and he had such depth and breadth of knowledge. Because if he hadn't, he would have been relegated to realistic fiction. I don't say that only to be insulting or flippant or anything like that. Because there are plenty of really brilliant writers who stick purely to what we might call realistic versus imaginative fiction. But there's really no way to create that, to create a whole story world or dig all the way into deep secondary creation if you don't have a vast library of references and resources, and not only vast, but a very deep one in which you're reaching into some of the deepest and most powerful myths that we have. You can't create successful imaginative story worlds if you don't have all of that. Am I going as far as to say it's much harder than doing excellent realistic? Yeah, I guess so. If you're going to do imaginative fiction that is as great as the greatest realistic fiction, the former is much harder because it takes so much more. And so that if you come across somebody like Frank Herbert or like J.R.R. Tolkien, you at the very least know that they had a lot to work with. And so I'll let Frank Herbert describe his thinking in the sandworm creation. Actually, Wikipedia has a great excerpt of Frank Herbert speaking about this. And I think it's an essay of his, or Frank Herbert's, this comes from. Anyway, he says, "The elements of any mythology must grow from something profoundly moving. Something which threatens to overwhelm any consciousness which tries to confront the primal mystery. Yet, after the primal confrontation, the roots of this threat must appear as familiar and necessary as your own flesh. For this, I give you the sandworms of Dune. The extension of human lifespan cannot be an unmitigated blessing. Every such acquisition requires a new consciousness, and a new consciousness assumes that you will confront dangerous unknowns. You will go into the deeps." So what's he getting at with that? Well, he has offered us a dragon that protects a great treasure. Frank Herbert, of course, Frank Herbert was also a huge fan of the deep myths, but of dragons in particular that guarded great treasures, such as the dragon in Beowulf. The dragon and the myth of Jason and his search for the golden fleece. All right, and these dragons are these deep, dangerous, unknown things. And he gave us his version of, well, we call them dragons now, but they were called worms, right? He gives us his version of this worm as this thing that guards this great treasure, the spice, because you can't get to it unless you figure out how to contend with these monsters out in the desert. Plus, there's always underground, and so they could pop up from under the surface and nab you at any point. And so all these technologies and all these not just technologies, but systems and entire cultures built around just trying to survive the dangers that the sandworms present on this planet. And so the greatest treasure in the universe is protected by these great dragons, Frank Herbert. And the treasure pays off, right? You get this vast life. You get a godlike mind, but not for free. You don't get to just, it must be paid for, right? And so what do you have to do? You have to go out and battle the dragon before you can reap the benefits of the treasure. And battling the dragon not only means putting your life at risk, and so taking on real risk, but it also means plunging yourself into the unknown. And if ever there was a deep, say, collective unconscious symbol of the unknown or the unconscious, it would be anything under the surface, whether it's under the surface of the water. And we already kind of got to that in our Serpents and Dragons episodes about how many of these dangerous serpents and dragons come up from under the water or exist under the surface of the water. But Frank Herbert took it below the surface of the earth, or an ocean like earth, which are these great vast deserts of loose sand. And so the dragons come up out of the sand, and it hides the treasure in the sand. And so you have to plunge yourself into the unknown, into the unconscious, and into the underworld and the dangers of death and chaos in order to come back up, not only with the treasure, but transformed. And so that's what Paul Atreides has to do in order to reach a higher level of consciousness. And ultimately his big, rite of passage is one among the indigenous peoples of Arrakis, which is to summon one of these sandworms and to ride it. And these sandworms, of course, are not only dangerous and not only poisonous, but they have like this electrical feel too between the segments. They're pretty much impossible to kill. Anything short of nuclear explosion can't even hurt them, really. And they're also attracted to anything that has a mechanical-like rhythm, even if that's just people walking in a very steady rhythm, because the desert winds push the sand around almost in a more natural, chaotic rhythm. The animals scurry around of the desert on the surface. They scurry around in a chaotic rhythm. And so there's something about chaos and nature being one and the same. And then in come like the steady hum of machines, or the steady pace of soldiers, and that's what attracts the worm. So how do you walk through the desert without being swallowed up by these worms, these great sand dragons? Well, you walk without rhythm, or you find a way to become one with the chaos and the unknown and the nature itself. And that's how you begin to not only avoid the danger of the dragon, but to kind of harness that. And of course, you then literally harness that power when you harness it and ride it as your rite of passage for hundreds of miles extremely fast across Dune or Arrakis. It's a deep symbol, and it's a deep mythology, a deep symbol in that after everything I just explained, I haven't really unpacked it all, and much of it remains a mystery as well. And that's more to the merit of Frank Herbert and his great creations, his storytelling creations. So there's at least a brief glimpse into his deep take on the worm and the dragon being one and the same as it once was in Old English. But I want to posit perhaps another one of his sources. And I would say it's one I've referred to in a previous episode. I think it was when I was talking about monstrous birds, because it has to do with the phoenix. I think I referenced it. I might not have. If I haven't, sorry. But the Greek apocalypse of Baruch, I should say, which the story goes, he was like a servant of the prophet Jeremiah. And we get Baruch's vision given to him by angels and in this tour of heaven. And he gets to see the great phoenix, which acts as like this cosmic bird that brings about night and day. And in this vision, when he's seeing the phoenix and he's being told by the angel what this is and how it works, and he keeps asking about the phoenix, like, what does it eat, and what does it, and how does it, what's its name, and all this stuff. And he also asks, and does the bird excrete? And like, what does he? That's an odd question, I guess, to ask of this cosmic creature in heaven. But the angel's like, and the angel said to me, he excretes a worm, and the excrement of the worm is cinnamon, which kings and princes use. Now, it just so happens that Frank Herbert's great sandworms, through their excretion, spice is made, this cinnamon-like thing, which, if I'm remembering correctly, also kind of smells of cinnamon, or there's some cinnamon connection with the worm. And kings and princes use the spice. And so did Frank Herbert get some further beyond just the Beowulf dragon, beyond just Jason and the Golden Fleece, or some of the other mythological dragons that we might know more of? Did he dig so deep as to get some of the apocryphal apocalypses and find that out? Or maybe into the mythology of the worms that excrete cinnamon from the phoenix? I think so. My God, I didn't realize how far I am into this episode already. I didn't get to talk about the one that mattered most to me yet, so I'm going to jump straight there. And I think it was fourth grade for me, this movie came out, and it blew my mind. And still to this day, I think it meets all the qualifications of a perfect film, as in it is what it aims to be and beyond, and it is everything you could ask of it if it remains the kind of thing that it sets out to be. It's this movie from 1990, and it's called Tremors. And I tell you what, this was my world. When you're a little kid in elementary school, and maybe I was too old to like play pretend and stuff. I should have probably been trying to play like some basketball or something like that, but that was just so dumb and boring to me. What was more interesting is to get my nerd friends together, we'd kind of play out the scenarios in which we were in the world of Tremors and various other beasts and monsters as well. But Tremors, oh my God. And so you've got this like this little western town isolated from the rest of the world, and you've got these kind of a handful of rednecks who are mostly kind of just good at doing very basic things, whether it's like Bert and Reba. Her name wasn't Reba, but it's Reba McEntire, so I just always know him as Bert and Reba. One of them's a character's name, the other one's an actress name, who are really good at their guns and reloading and taking care of themselves. They're like these prepper type of people, and that's why they're living out in this isolated place. Or these two handymen. Who are our main characters. Anyway, you got this small town of these oddball outback kind of rednecks in this small little Western American desert town. And then they keep having these problems of like things being mysteriously destroyed, people being killed, livestock being killed, and then people being killed, and avalanches blocking the roads. And so it's a perfect horror film in that you very quickly isolate the characters. They can't get out, they can't get help. And this threat comes, and in a great horror film, the threat can come from anywhere in three dimensions, or sometimes four dimensions, but anywhere in three dimensions, you just never quite know. And in this case, it comes up from the ground. And so the Tremors end up, well, they, there's this great moment in the, it's so funny. This is, the film is so, because it works perfectly as this like comedy adventure. It also works perfectly as this horror film. They do the characters so well. Everybody gets their little moments exactly right, and so they also, there's this college researcher is out there trying to figure out what's up with these seismic anomalies, and it's these giant beasts swimming under the surface of the earth. And there's this hilarious moment when they're all in this like general store arguing about what we should call the monster is. and it rings so much of like one of the writer's room sessions of like, what should we call them? So the movie's called Tremors, but tradition has taken it to call them the last thing that a guy named Walter came up with before he was subsequently eaten by one of them, which is graboids, because they're these giant worm-like things that when they open their three-part beak, which of course is the sandworms in Frank Herbert's Dune, and they're also these gigantic worms the size of a house, or maybe even bigger, train-sized things. Again, Frank Herbert's Dune. When they open up their mouths, out shoot these snake-like tentacles. And so that's another great feature of these kind of the good monster horror, is that you just see glimpses of it early on and you don't know how to piece it all together, much like it was done perfectly in Alien. And so it seems like these separate little snakes that pop up out of the ground, but those end up just being the three-tongued tentacles of this thing that grabs you and sucks you down under the earth and then eats you. And it ends up being able to hear your walking, and so everybody not only has to be very quiet and move around as quietly as possible, but to get up off the ground. Of course, these things are so big that they can pull down cars and suck you in with it, or they can even start to take out the foundations of buildings, and so they're not quite safe. Essentially, what... ever since the movie Jaws came out, I don't know if the book did this, but to the industry, but I'm pretty sure the movie is responsible. There's this like cliche of the producer who doesn't really get story and doesn't really want anything original. They just want stars. They want stuff that will sell tickets. And they want everything to be like Jaws. I think even Mitchell and Webb have a great sketch as sketch comedy bit in which they're having to deal with one of these people. Like, yeah, you've got a nice, quiet English drama about this relationship here, but could you make it, and I'm not saying make it like this, but could you make it more like Jaws? And why do like these kind of shallow-minded producers love Jaws so much? Well, it's really great, and everybody can get it and be afraid of it at a very basic level. And I think it also hints at something much deeper, as in these monsters under the surface, in the way that we discussed the unconscious and the unknown and the danger with the sandworms in Dune. And so I think there's a lot to it, but I think ever since, you've got all sorts of movies that want to get funding and want to get producers all for it end up having to do something in their shows or in their movies that makes somebody say, it's kind of like Jaws, except that instead of the ocean, it is blank. And you just fill in the blank, like Stranger Things. Like, that's one of the things that help them get the money for Stranger Things. It's like in the first season, it's like this thing. It's like this monster will come out and get you, just like Jaws, except it's in the walls rather than in the water. Like, they literally said that. And then it worked because they got funding. And so what do you get here? It's like Jaws, except under the, instead of water, it's the sand. But it's so great. Oh my God. So I'm definitely running out of time, but I'll tell you, it's one of the greatest scenes in cinema history is this moment in which you got these these kind of loony preppers that everybody else in town are a little bit annoyed with because they're like persnickety, even though they're rednecks, they're just like so particular and all darn it that, they want everybody to like arm themselves better and prepare better and do what they tell them to do in order for everyone to survive more successfully. But they end up not really knowing what these trimmers are or all about until after everybody else does. And so by the time everyone else in town is freaking out and they figured it out enough, and we've got not just one, and it's not just small but big, but we've got several, and they're hungry and they're hunting and they're ready to eat us all, and everybody else is on the rooftops. And then that's when Bert and Reba, you're gonna kill me if you're a huge Tremor fan for calling them Bert and Reba, but it's since elementary school that's what they've been to me. So Bert and Reba finally get back, and they go down into their basement and they start reloading ammo with these what are essentially big sand shakers to polish the shells. And so it's making a whole bunch of noise and a whole bunch of vibration, and everybody's on the walkie-talkies trying to get in touch with them, like, they're coming for you, get out of the basement, get on your roof. And they don't hear it in time, and then in busts the monster, the graboid, I always called them trimmers, and bust this trimmer graboid through the wall there to eat them. And they start shooting the thing, and they run out of ammo, and you're like, oh no, they're both gonna die. And then the camera pans with them as they go back to the other wall, and it's just this wall of guns, like thousands of guns, and every imaginable make and model and caliber. And so it's just this long scene, much like that great scene in Predator when they're just shooting the jungle and deforesting, offering high caliber deforestation to South America or Central America. They're just like unloading so much. And then they eventually, of course, get this double-barreled elephant gun. And that's what it takes to finally pierce through to the vital organs of this thing and kill it. And so you get this great scene. And by the end of it, Bert screaming, broke into the wrong goddamn rec room, didn't you, you bastard? Just a wonderful moment if you've ever been part redneck and part monster fan, or all of both. And I think I am in many ways all of both. I think Tremors is one of the great, my dad used to call it, that's a diamond in the rough, boy. That film is a diamond in the rough. By that he meant like it's this cheesy like 1950s giant animal monster movie that is so much greater than it ought to be, and in fact is something classic and grand. And then the more I got into storytelling, and even the more formal my education became, the more I understood that wasn't at all wrong. That was exactly true. In many ways, it is an absolutely perfect film. I have only just barely scratched the surface of it and talked about one scene. But I guess we got into the deepest parts of Worm as monster. Oh, we never got into the sandworms and Beetlejuice. And the, oh God, and there's so many other ones. Anyway, I got to the ones I really cared about. Shamir, the sandworms in Dune, and then in Tremors. Well, let's call that, I'm past my 40-minute time limit I tried to set on myself, and so let's call it good at that. And if you've made it this far, then you survived another episode. So good job. I hope you got something worthwhile out of it, if only entertainment or leads of cool things to check out. And I'll talk to you next time on The Monster Professor.